The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. On Tuesday, October 1st, the National Safer Supply Community of Practice, up in that northern part of Abiyala, currently referred to colonially as Canada, held one of its research spotlight webinars, this one entitled Safer Supply Ottawa Evaluation Summer 2024 Report. On this edition of Century, we're going to hear some highlights from that event. But first, loyal listeners will recall that my home state of Oregon recently took a big step backwards in drug policy by recriminalizing the simple possession of small amounts of some drugs. Some friends have asked me how things are going out here, so I thought, well, in case listeners are wondering the same thing, I'll give you a quick update. The Oregon State Legislature is out of session, but as a friend who's been a lobbyist down at the state capitol in Salem always says, if you want to be effective at the Oregon Legislature, then you have to be there between sessions, because that's when a lot of the real work gets done. If you only show up down there during the actual session, and you're really just a spectator. We have what's called a part-time legislature, so our legislative sessions are quite short, and the interim between sessions is when the groundwork gets done and bills get written. The Oregon Legislature's Joint Interim Committee on Addiction and Community Safety Response met on September 24th to hear invited testimony. One of the witnesses was Ken Sanchagrin, Executive Director of the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission, testifying on the rollout and implementation of deflection programs around the state. Let's hear some of the Q&A that followed his presentation. The first voice you hear will be that of committee co-chair, Senator Floyd Prozanski.
Thank you. Ken, I had a couple of different questions. It's really deflection versus diversion. Hearing the news and some of the applications, the grants that have gone through, it seemed to me what I was hearing is actually individuals weren't being deflected out. They're going into the system, and what I think I understood, you said the data that you have here today is based on arrest or citations. So that means they're coming into the criminal justice system. That means they have to be afforded an attorney. So that's a public defense issue, in which we all know we're trying to deal with the public defense services crisis. So now we're seeing the compounding of that. So is there, and then also I'm hearing, and you've mentioned some of this, some of the counties are putting limitations on who can get into deflection. I mean, where's the, I mean, to me, this is for us. Where are we going with this? I mean, the reality is we're basically setting up a system that's going to have not equal protection across all of the counties as to each person, depending on what county you're in. Either you get deflected or you go into the court system. You go into the court system, and if you don't have the ability to pay for your own attorney, we have to be doing that, and we already have a crisis. So was there not any guidance, or can we have some type of measure as to how many are actually being deflected? I looked at the statute and the sections 36 and 37, pages 30 and through 31, kind of reflect as to what a deflection is versus it doesn't say diversion, but what it would be the alternative. But it seems like the grants came in and people are labeling it as a deflection, but it's not a deflection. It's actually into the criminal justice system, and then we're diverting them out of the criminal justice system, and they're calling it deflection. And I think that's the wrong message we want to be sending to the public. I mean, either we deflect or we divert, and trying to allow for people to get grant money on a diversion program and calling it deflection, that's not being true.
Co-Chair Prozanski, the tack that, and certainly this is an issue that brought on very much discussion in our grant review committee, and I think that when we as staff read the definition of deflection that was provided statutorily, it was written very broadly, and so when I have talked, for example, about where deflection sits within the intervention models, for example, we're looking at maybe intervention zero, which might be the most fruitful place for true deflection. Or I've added my own site at 0.5 as opposed to one, and that's because when we did a deeper analysis of many of the programs that suggested or brought about a criminal case and then scheduled an arraignment, there was still an aim by those programs to have deflection eligibility determined and deflection of that individual occur before that arraignment began. It may not always happen that way, but that's at least, I think, what we were looking at as far as the timing of those programs and why I might refer to it as kind of step one half. I think that when we, the commission has been asked to file a best practices report that will be due in April of this coming year. That will be where we're able to lay out much more directly this difference between deflection and diversion. I have to admit, from my personal standpoint, I view it a bit more as a continuum as opposed to discrete steps. But that's what that report will speak to. And then two, 6 months after that, we have an additional report that will take those best practices and the data that we have from our counties, and we'll be able to show which counties are being more successful. And so going to your comment on some counties having greater degree of restriction as to who can enter into those programs, I think the data will be very telling at that point. If we have a county that only has 10 participants after essentially a year in operation, and perhaps only two people succeeded compared to other counties that have hundreds of participants and a higher level of success, then I think that'll be a point of discussion for you all as you look at this program moving forward.
So follow up,
please.
So what I'm hearing is that at this point, maybe the legislature in 2025 need to actually put forward what is deflection versus what is diversion. Because if we're having grants that are supposed to be on deflection, but people are interpreting it differently, and it's broad enough that you can actually take a diversion program and have money coming that's a deflection program. And when you look at the statute or the subsection, it makes it pretty clear to me that it's you're keeping people out of the criminal justice system. And if you're citing them, arresting them, they're in the system. Thanks. We'll work on this.
Okay. Yes. Thank you, Co-Chair. As a granting agency, we would love additional clarification. Sure. Thank you.
Representative Alderon.
Chair, I have a question in a similar vein about slides 5 and 6. You talk about some of the specific grants that have already been allocated to those 27 programs and the 28 counties, and a little bit more detail about some of the resources on slide 6 and the number of resources that actually go to predominantly treatment, it looks like. And then the very last slide on this deck that wasn't, I think, mentioned, or maybe very briefly, just the arrests by county. And if you kind of overlay that map on slide 5 with the arrests on the very last slide 20, it looks really similar. So can you talk about a little bit more specifically these grant awards, and I guess reconcile for me these dollars in treatment versus some of those high arrests that I'm seeing in those counties?
Sure, and I'll go to that appendix slide just for the benefit of the committee. Rep. Valderrama, that's a good question. I don't think that we have thought too deeply, in all honesty, about the overlay between those two maps. My initial reaction is that the maps somewhat match where we have the greatest volume or the greatest numbers of folks. And also, at least when we look at some of our counties, for example, Jackson County, which has the highest number, their program is not yet operational. They're scheduled for an October rollout. However, we look at some of our other counties with higher numbers. You know, Multnomah County is operating. They don't have their center open yet, but they do have peer coverage during the day. So some of those arrests are likely happening after hours when peers could be located. And then also Clackamas and Washington County, you know, their approach is to cite individuals and to schedule arraignments. And so we see a higher number of arrests there that wouldn't necessarily surprise me. But we've not done a deep analysis of overlaying those two yet. So I don't have anything more than those off-the-cuff thoughts, at least at this point.
That was Ken Santigran, Executive Director of the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission, answering questions from the Oregon Legislature's Joint Interim Committee on Addiction and Community Safety Response at a hearing on September 24th. Before we go on, I must say, Senator Przanski was quite right about deflection programs. As noted by the National Conference of State Legislatures in its August 2023 publication entitled The Legislative Primer Series for Front-End Justice, Deflection and Diversion, quote, "Deflection programs occur before arrest or prior to initiation of a law enforcement or other justice system contact," end quote. That primer further explains that according to the sequential intercept model, quote, Deflection programs generally take place at intercepts 0 and 1. Diversion programs come into play at intercepts 2 and 3. End quote. Now, intercept 0 is community service. Law enforcement doesn't even show up until intercept 1. Intercept 2 is the arrest, formally titled initial detention slash initial court hearings. Intercept 3 is jail slash courts. Intercept 4 is reentry. Intercept 5 is community service, which is a rather poor euphemism for parole and probation. You can find that document at the National Conference website, ncsl.org. It's well worth reading. One hopes that Director Sanchagrin will download and read a copy soon. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Next week, we'll hear more on the folly of recriminalization in Oregon. For now, as I mentioned at the top of the show, on Tuesday, October 1st, the National Safer Supply Community of Practice, up in that northern part of Abya-Yala, currently referred to colonially as Canada, held one of its research spotlight webinars, this one entitled Safer Supply Ottawa Evaluation, Summer 2024 Report. Marlene Haynes, RN, PhD, is a researcher and nurse practitioner student in the School of Nursing at the University of Ottawa.
So just very briefly, for those of you who may not be familiar with the program here in Ottawa, so Ottawa brings together seven different organizations that are all working toward providing comprehensive care and services for the community of people who use drugs. So there are three prescribing sites that you can see at the top there, which includes Somerset West, Ottawa Inner City Health and Recovery Care. And then they, with the prescribing, they also provide things like primary care and sometimes supervised injection services where they're linked up for the programs that are linked up with, for example, a supervised consumption site. And then we have our really essential, really important kind of supporting partners who include places like Sandy Hill that does intensive case management for the clients and offers lots of great peer connections. There's Respect Pharmacy that does some home deliveries for people and offers pro bono meds for people when they're kind of having periodic drug coverage issues. Ottawa Public Health has been really essential in kind of creating, helping us to create guidelines and policies that make sense for our clients. And also they continue to collect citywide data on substance use and related outcomes, which is great. And then Options by Town as well has been a fantastic partner. And they do kind of on-site housing workers and really take a focus on people who are homeless or people who are kind of precariously or unstably housed. And then just to kind of give, I won't go through this entire slide. It's been in all of our reports so far, and it will be in this one as well. But just to kind of give an overview of the philosophy of care. So even though we have all of these different partners kind of working together, really at the end of the day, despite day-to-day program differences and operations and things like that, you know, the philosophy of care, as well as the ethical and kind of moral standing and beliefs of the program as a whole remain really, really cohesive, which has been really fantastic over the past few years. So taking a focus on things like making sure people who use drugs are partners in care, you know, being committed to lifelong learning and altering the programs when it's needed, advocating for things like drug decriminalization, things like that. So that's always kind of grounded us and brought everyone together in their similarities. So normally I have, and you probably saw on the invitation or the email that you got, that I normally have Athena, who does a lot of kind of the data collection chart reviews stuff. She couldn't be here today. All of her data will be available in the report, and there's no major changes from previous reports, but it will be fun to kind of see in there. So, but since she's not here today, I just thought I'd give a really brief overview of just to say we have kind of multiple different types of programs. So certainly the Safer Opiate Supply program is the most popular, followed by kind of a combination program when people are given opiates and stimulants. And then people who are just on stimulants alone kind of are the smallest, but still very important group for a total of 470 participants. This data, I believe, was collected a while ago, maybe 6 months plus. So I think the programs have been grown since then, but still, you know, looking after and partnering with a large group of people who use drugs and kind of providing care to them. So I'm going to jump right into the research that we did for the evaluation, which was really a lot of fun, and we kind of carried out over this past summer. What we wanted to focus on, because if I think back to our previous reports, the first report kind of looked at the program as a whole with a focus on opiates. The second report dialed in really to stimulants and did more like chart reviews on people who were on the stimulant program alone. And then the third report looked at people who we wanted to understand more the kind of gaps in care where people were who were frequently being restarted on the program. So people who were having troubles with, you know, being able to stick to the program regularly. We noticed that the clients brought it up and we wanted to understand it more. So those were all really fantastic projects. For this upcoming project, something that we were noting though, and I'm sure many of you can speak to this from your communities as well, is there's continues to be so many harms to people who use stimulants. The drug supply continues to, you know, become increasingly toxic for everyone. But I think what's really important to call out is the fact that there just simply aren't a lot of options for people who use stimulants. Not to say that what we have for people who use opiates is enough either, but certainly there is more of a spectrum of services available for people who use opiates. Whereas, you know, there is no gold standard, for example, medication necessarily that everyone kind of agrees upon for people who use stimulants. And there are not a lot of safer stimulant supply programs available across the country. And so we thought that was a really important thing to focus on. So we decided to focus on safer stimulants. Again, kind of given the limited evidence surrounding this topic. And we really did want to understand, you know, participant outcomes and just speak to them and complete a more in-depth exploration of the impact of the program from their perspective. Briefly, the research objectives were to kind of evaluate the outcomes of safer stimulants, to kind of really get into and better understand the motivations and experiences of being on this type of program, to explore the facilitators and barriers of this program, and then also to inform those future directions, because we're always looking ahead about what can we change, what needs to change, how can we improve, and how can we look ahead. The research questions then involved things like, you know, directly asking people about the impact of participating, what sorts of kind of personal health and behavioral changes they might be experiencing that are important to them, and are they able to meet the goals that they set out to achieve when they first joined the program. So we did surveys and interviews with 27 participants across the two current safer stimulant supply sites. So although there's three prescribing sites, two of them offer safer stimulants at this time, which includes Recovery Care and Somerset West. So the interviews were semi-structured. They took anywhere from 15 to 60 minutes, depending on how much people had to say. And we used a thematic analysis to kind of analyze the interview transcripts afterwards. The surveys were important and they were completed to collect information about participant socio-demographic data and self-reports about changes to health and substance use behaviors. Participants were compensated $100 cash for their time and expertise for kind of spending time with us and really teaching us about how things have been going. So just to really roughly break it down, like I said, it was 27 people and we spoke from 8 people from Somerset West and then the remaining 19 from Recovery Care. You see two different Recovery Cares there because they do have multiple sites across the city, which is great for clients to be able to access depending on where they're coming from. But the main ones are Byward, which is kind of like our downtown, and Vanier as well. So jumping into demographics, participants had a median age of 40 years. They had a median time on safer supply of 18 months. Just over half of the participants were men. The majority of people were born in Canada, and 16 participants reported their ethnicity as white, 7 as Indigenous, and 4 as other. I do want to point out that things are grouped under the heading other or are grouped like this to protect patient confidentiality, because of course with a small sample size and 27 people, and with the particular focusing on safer stimulants, which is an even smaller group compared to kind of the larger safer supply cohort here in Ottawa, we just want to make sure that we're not giving any sort of information that could cause somebody to, you know, know who it was that participated. So I just wanted to point out that that's what the other is there for. And then men and women, cis and transgender, were also grouped together, again, for the same reasons, to protect confidentiality, just because there were so few people who identified as transgender. So most participants reported their sexual orientation to be heterosexual. Almost 3/4 of the participants said that they only spoke English. And most commonly, people said that the highest level of education that they completed was less than high school. We did ask participants, similar again to previous reports, about their lifetime drug use. So you can see that, you know, crack cocaine, fentanyl, and hydromorphone were the most common. Everybody said that they had used it at one point or another across their lifespan. And then the median age when participants first used drugs was 14. And the median age when participants began to use stimulants was 18. And I want you to really try and remember these numbers for when we get into the quotes and the interviews, because I think it helps to contextualize some of the themes that really kind of came out during analysis. So for substance use complications before they started the Safer Supply program, we kind of asked participants to reflect back on what was happening at that time in their life. So all participants reported some form of a complication as a result of, as a direct result of their unregulated drug use before they started the program. So most commonly people spoke about things like feeling like they had to, or feeling like they had to or were forced to participate in criminalized behaviors, kind of experiencing legal issues. And then as well, hepatitis C infections were also really commonly discussed. So when we asked participants about where they use drugs in general, I think this is really important to understand what's happening in the community, where are resources needed, where are supports needed. And so people mostly spoke about that they were using substances most commonly, either at their own home or at someone else's house, followed by supervised consumption sites and then public and shelter. And then we have 4 consumption sites in the city. And so people most commonly reported using at one of the downtown ones, which was Ottawa Inner City Health, followed by Somerset West. So with regards to accessing harm reduction services, several participants noted that they found it really easy to access different harm reduction services because commonly their programs, the Safer Supply programs themselves, housed some of these harm reduction services. So this became, you know, a really convenient thing for them. So for example, with the take-home naloxone, you know, any of the Safer Supply programs will have that very readily accessible and easy for clients to get. Or if they're wanting to do things like picking up sterile supplies, again, they can do that right within their program. So participants were certainly accessing harm reduction services on a really regular basis. So looking at kind of pre and post self-reported measures for clients, we felt that these were important findings to be able to understand kind of how Safe Supply might be impacting things, again, from the client perspective. So for mental health, we asked people to rate their mental health from a scale of 0 to 5, with 0 being poor and 5 being excellent, before and after the program. So before, Safer Supply participants reported a median score of 2 out of 5. And after, they reported a median score, or currently being in the program, they reported a median score for mental health of 4 out of 5. So an interesting change just to note there. With overdoses, we asked people to report if they were experiencing any drug overdoses before the program. And then again, since starting, interestingly, more than half of the participants reported experiencing an overdose event before starting the program. But then since starting the program, the majority have not experienced an overdose event since. Something that I think is important is this graph really does fail to capture the impact that Safer Supply has had. What I mean by this is several participants reported that before Safer Supply, they were overdosing daily or multiple times a day. And then since joining the program, they've experienced maybe 1 or 2 overdose events total, unrelated to their Safer Supply medication. But this group who has experienced 1 or 2 overdoses since starting would still be included within this kind of any overdose event afterwards group. So although we didn't quantify that, and I think that's something that would be useful to do in the future, I just wanted to point that out. So participants were also asked about how their unregulated stimulant use has changed. This can, of course, be a really difficult thing to quantify. You know, I'm sure everyone here, clinicians, researchers, anybody, people with lived experience, it can be really hard to nail down exactly what you're using each day, especially with how, you know, toxic and how fluctuating the drug supply is day to day. But people were able to kind of give us kind of estimates over time. So, and this was important too, because one of the most commonly expressed goals of participants was to change their drug use in some form. So before starting the program, people reported using a median of 10 points of crack cocaine a day, or about 1 gram. And since being on the program, participants reported using a median of 1 point a day. And so the same thing for crystal meth. Before starting the program, people reported using a median of 5 points a day. And since being on Safer Supply, participants reported using a median of 0 points per day. This was really amazing to hear from the perspective of clients. Of course, I do want to point out that we used median, and median, when it says 0 points a day, it doesn't, of course, mean that everybody's using 0 points per day, but just that that was kind of the median number that was given out. And we use median too because it does tend to be more of a conservative estimate of things, especially when you're working with kind of smaller groups like this. So this is kind of how we wanted to approach this kind of speaking with people. But even then, again, really interesting to see kind of from their perspective the changes in their substance use. Really exciting. Before Safer Supply, most people said they were staying in a shelter, and the remaining participants said they were either housed. There was four people who said that, housed, nine people said that, or unstably housed, four people said that. And then since joining Safer Supply, the number of participants who were staying in the shelter decreased from kind of that 14 to 5, and the number of people who reported being housed increased substantially to 21. I think for anyone who's worked in shelters or works with people who are unstably housed or people who are experiencing homelessness, you know that it can take a really long time, even with all the effort being made, to find someone housing. And so I think just thinking back again to that 18-month median of people being on the program, this is a really interesting thing to consider as well. Anecdotally, people spoke about things like that wraparound care, the peers, the housing workers, and the stability that they received from the program being really essential to them being able to find housing. And then as it relates to income before starting the program, not everyone may know these exact programs, but nearly half the participants were on Ontario Works. And 41% were on ODSP or Ontario Disability Support Program, and 4 were reporting another source of income. And since joining the program, the majority of participants were receiving ODSP. I think what this says is, getting on ODSP can be arduous. I've filled out many applications in my time. There's lots and lots of paperwork to do and supporting things that you need to attach. And I think that, it's people reported, and again, anecdotally, that getting onto the program helped them to be able to do that. They got access to, supports and people who could assist them with being able to get on access to services that they were qualified for. As for criminalized behavior, most people said that they were engaging in some form of criminalized behavior before doing Safe Supply. And then since starting, almost 2/3 reported no longer engaging. I think what's important as well is that among the remaining participants who continued to engage in criminalized behavior, all of them reported that their criminalized behavior had decreased since starting the program. And so to better understand criminalized behavior, they were asked to kind of indicate the types of behaviors they were participating in before and after Safe Supply, if any. And so overall, participants reported a decrease in all categories of criminalized behaviors after joining the program, and with drug dealing being the most impacted with a 40% decrease, followed by theft with a 29% decrease.
That was Marlene Haynes, RN, PhD, a researcher and nurse practitioner student in the School of Nursing at the University of Ottawa, presenting the Safer Supply Ottawa Evaluation Summer 2024 report on a webinar organized by the National Safer Supply Community of Practice. You can find a copy of that report, along with a lot of great materials, on the National Safer Supply Community of Practice website, substanceusehealth.ca. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.